Just Energy with naturopath and medical intuitive Dr. Rita Louise. We have learned from Einstein's theories that matter and energy are one. Physicists believe that all systems in nature have their own particular way of vibrating. From the swing of a pendulum to the waves in the ocean to the light that brightens the sky each day, each of these oscillates at its own unique rate. In the same way, things such as rocks and minerals vibrate very slowly and at speeds that are imperceptible to us. Living things such as plants, animals, and man vibrate faster and appear to be alive. The same holds true for every thought, feeling, event, or word we speak. Each has its own frequency or rate of vibration. What many of us don't realize is if we take everything in our own universe down to its simplest form, it is all just energy. Join Dr. Rita as she explores questions such as, what are we made of? Why do we get sick? How can I live a more balanced and whole life? Call in and talk to her and her thought-provoking guests. Send us your questions and get the help you need to move beyond any obstacle or challenges that may be affecting your life, right from the source. So stay tuned and explore your possibility.
Hello and welcome to Just Energy Radio. I'm Dr. Rita Louise and thank you all for tuning into the show today. We're going to be talking about a topic that I thought I knew a lot about, but apparently not. And we're going to be talking about Gnosticism. And to do that, we'll be speaking with Andrew Philip Smith, live from, I think, the UK. But before we bring Andrew on, I have a couple of little announcements. Of course, we will be doing the mind yoga question of the day, and I'll be announcing the winner of last week's question because, yes, ding, 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 we did have a winner. And also, mark your calendars, July 19th at 7 p.m. Central Time, I will be doing a free teleconference entitled The Heart and Soul of Healing. Now, you can get more information about this teleconference at globalteleclasses.com, or if you go to any of my millions of websites, there's a link to it. But we'll be taking a comprehensive look at how our thoughts and emotions play into our ability to maintain health. And so you'll be discovering the true nature of illness and disease and learn how to recognize disease patterns in your life before they actually manifest into the physical body. And the best thing of all, you get to, well, two things. One, you get to hang out with me. And two, it's free. And, you know, we like free. Again, the information is at globalteleclass.com, July 19th at 7 p.m. Central Time. So let me tell you a little bit about Andrew, and we will bring him on the show. Andrew Philip Smith was born in Wales in 1966 and currently lives in Dublin, Ireland. He is the author of several books about Gnosticism and related subjects, including The Gnostics, History, Tradition, and Scriptures and Influence, The Gospel of Philip, Annotated and Explained, Gnostic Writings on the Soul, Annotated and Explained, Lost Sayings of Jesus, and a dictionary, which I think is his newest book, A Dictionary of Gnosticism. So please welcome to Just Energy Radio from AndrewPhilipSmith.com, Andrew Philip Smith. Hey, Andrew, how are you today?
Hi, Rita. Do I call you Rita or Dr. Rita?
Rita is just fine.
Rita's fine. doing well. It's a pleasant, breezy evening in Dublin, in Ireland. The rain has stopped, and we've got a couple of hours more sunlight left here. We're quite far north, so the sun isn't setting until about 10:30 in the evening here.
Well, that's wonderful. We're in the outskirts of a hurricane.
Really?
Because there was a hurricane that went into the Gulf of Mexico, you know, by the oil spill, which is always thrilling. And I guess it hit land yesterday, and so the arms, I guess, you know, we're in one of the arms, and it was just raining, but it seems as if the rain has stopped. So I don't think it's going to be really that bad. I mean, we're far enough away that we'll get some rain, but not, you know, the big winds that you would associate with a hurricane.
Yes, I hope
it's always exciting in Texas.
Oh, you're in Texas.
I'm in Texas, correct. Well, it seems as if you have a great amount of information about the Gnostics, and as I was saying to you before we went live, I read your book on the Gnostics, History, Tradition, and Scriptures Influence, and found out that I really didn't know a whole lot about them, even though I thought I did. And so for the people that are listening that aren't even familiar with the Gnostics and Gnosticism, who are the Gnostics and where did they come from?
Well, both of those questions are actually somewhat controversial among scholars. But basically, the Gnostics were several different interrelated groups and sects who were either Christian or closely related to Christianity, who flourished in the early centuries AD. We know that they existed from about the 2nd century to the 4th century and a little on after that, and then they had different there were various successor groups like the Manichaeans, the Paulicians, the Bogomils, and the Cathars, who stretched up to the medieval times. And they it's very likely that they preceded the second century in some way or other. But the details of that are kind of lost in the murky past. And in fact, historically, we don't know an awful lot about the Gnostics as people. But anyway, so they were, by what became the mainstream Christians, that became the Roman Catholic Church, the Orthodox Church, they were called heretics, people who had their own views about Christianity, but in the views of the mainstream church were the wrong views. They were heretical. And again, because these are lots of little groups who aren't a big centralized movement, and who are very inventive and creative. So when you come to summarize their ideas, you have to have a skeleton of the, you know, all the different versions of the Gnostic myth and the Gnostic worldview that they had. But the basic idea was that the world that we live in, the material world, is a fallen world, and our souls are trapped in our bodies in this world. But we each have a spark of divinity within us, which has come from the higher world. And we can reawaken that spark, we can reignite it, fan it into a flame, and ascend back into the heavenly world, and return to our birthright. And then they have what's often quite a complex myth to explain how this all happened. Again, lots of different versions of it, lots of takes. They elaborated it, then they simplified it, then they went off in different directions. It's very fascinating to look at all the different versions of these and compare them. And, you know, very different to the emerging Orthodox movement at the time, you know, which by the 3rd century was starting to get very concerned about saying exactly what was right and exactly what the view of Jesus should be, you know, exactly what the view of the Trinity should be. You know, everything was being made hard and fast by the Orthodox or the proto-Orthodox movement at that time. But the Gnostics were very creative. They were still developing their ideas and writing them out and coming up with new versions. So the basic myth is that in the beginning we have God, the one original true God, who has unity, and that's all that exists. I mean, he's often described as father and given a male gender, you know, which is very common for the times, but this is a unique being at the very beginning. And then something happens that sometimes it's that God wants to know himself, you know, or to see himself, to see what he is, as if in a mirror. And the act of looking in a mirror produces a reflection. So there's an image of God, and there's a sort of, in a way, a second being there. And it's almost as if we have, you know, two mirrors reflecting each other, and, you know, the images get repeated and the mirrors get smaller and smaller. So this first act of God, of wanting to know himself, of looking at himself, results in all these beings emanating from God, which are part of God still, and they represent different aspects of God, and they're called eons, A-E-O-N-S, which is a Greek word. And they all exist in the world of the Pleroma. As you can see, there are lots of obscure words when you start to study Gnosticism, which is why I wrote a dictionary to help people with that. But the Pleroma is a Greek word that means the fullness. So the Pleroma is the heavenly world, which is the fullness of God. So it's God and all of these beings that have emanated out of him and are still linked to him from this initial act of his. So everything's happy and fine and divine. But the last of these eons is called Sophia. Again, there are different versions of this. And Sophia wants to do something which means wisdom. It's, again, a Greek word, wisdom. And wisdom is a feminine being. And there was actually, even before the Gnostics, there was a tradition of wisdom, Lady Wisdom, in the latest books of the Old Testament, you know. That was a developing Hebrew idea before the Gnostics. So they took this figure of Lady Wisdom, and they made her into one of the eons emanating out from God. And so from their point of view, they needed to explain why the world has fallen. And the way that the Bible does this in the book of Genesis is it says it's fallen because human beings did it. Eve did it rather than Sophia. You know, Eve was tempted by the serpent. She gave the apple or the fruit of the tree of knowledge and good and evil to Adam. And the fall is a result of human sin. Yeah. So the Gnostics differed from this. They said that the fall, okay, it was the result of, again, of a female figure, unfortunately. it was the result of Sophia. She wanted to know, either to know the Father without going through all the sort of intermediaries, or she wanted to explore off into the unknown territory outside of the Pleroma, outside of the fullness of God. So whatever she did, it was illegitimate and it didn't work. And as a result, she became somewhat trapped outside of the Pleroma. And also as a result of this, she sort of, again, there's so many different versions of it, but you can consider that she mated with sort of the darkness outside of the Pleroma. And she gave birth to a misshapen, ignorant, ignoble creature, often called Yaldabaoth. That's Y-A-L-D-A-B-A-O-T-H. And he was actually called an abortion in some of the stories. Sophia gives birth to him. I mean, he knows a little bit about Sophia as his mother, but he starts to think that he's God. You know, there's all this world. He doesn't know anything about the Pleroma and about the true God and the heavenly world. And there's this all this unexplored, either nothingness or just chaos and brute matter. So he decides, and he's probably picked up the idea from the true God, he decides that he's going to create a world. And so he creates our material world. And then he creates also archons, another Greek word, A-R-C-H-O-N-S, which is a word which means like a ruler, like a petty ruler, like a government official, something like that. So Yaldabaoth, he's also called the Demiurge, once again, another Greek word, which means craftsman. And it was a word first as just to mean craftsman, but it was used by Plato for this idea of a second god who creates the world. Although Plato's version was a good god, the second god was still a good god who created the world. But the Gnostic version is that the second god who creates the world is an evil, ignorant god. So Yaldabaoth, the Demiurge, and his archons, he creates the world, and then he creates Adam and Eve. And interestingly, in a lot of the Gnostic writings, Eve is actually kind of higher being than Adam. She represents something of the spiritual world, whereas Adam is more earthly. And in Hebrew, the the word Adam comes from the word for earth. So Yaldabaoth and his archons, they try to create Adam and Eve, and they do it. They give him body and soul as well. The soul belongs to Yaldabaoth, the demiurge, and I think we have to understand that in terms of the ego, you know, the petty soul, you know, the little scheming soul that is tied to the body and just interested in the material world. So he creates the body and the soul in Adam and Eve, but Adam is stuck on the ground. He can't rise up at all. And through some trick or other, again, there are different versions of it, the other eons from the Pleroma, from the heavenly world, manage to put a little bit of spirit from the heavenly world into the human beings. And then the human being is like a complete being, even though it's, you know, humans are generally controlled by the demiurge. And then some of the Gnostics put a lot of importance on the third son of Adam and Eve, who was called Seth. Now, he's not very well known, and he's mentioned in the Bible, but there isn't very much about him, just a couple of verses. You know, the first children of Adam and Eve were Cain and Abel, the first murderer and the first victim. But Seth was the third child, and they attribute to Seth the sort of Gnostic lineage. So, and there's a whole group of Gnostics who are the most radical of them, who are called the Sethian Gnostics. They said that they were the seed of Seth, or the children of Seth, and they sort of trace at least their mythical descent from this third son of Adam and Eve. So Seth then becomes something of a kind of redeemer figure or a revealer figure. And the subsequent history of humanity involves the demiurge and his archons trying to control humanity, and they because the demiurge or Yaldabaoth thinks that he's God, he sets himself up as God, and he has his own version of religion. And as far as the Gnostics were concerned, you know, the mainstream Jewish and Christian religions were worshipping Yaldabaoth instead of the true God. They were duped by the demiurge. So the history of mankind is the demiurge and his archons trying to keep control of humanity. But these redeemer or revealer figures appearing every now and again to teach humanity how to have gnosis, yet another Greek word. And that's the word that the word Gnostic comes from, and Gnosticism. In Greek, it's gnosis, the original word. And that word means knowledge. And it's the kind of knowledge, it's not just book knowledge, although it's also, it is the kind of the Gnostic myths are part of the gnosis, and the whole understanding of our position is part of gnosis. But it's also this direct knowledge of God, you know, this experiential knowledge of God. We have this spark of spirit of the higher world within us, and that can be revealed within us, and we can experience it. And, you know, in fact, I would say that the way back to the higher world is to keep experiencing this, and that's what gnosis is. You know, gnosis is the experience of the divine within this framework of understanding how the universe came to be about and what we need to do. And so Jesus was also an example of a Gnostic redeemer, according to the Gnostics, or a Gnostic revealer. He brought teachings and brought gnosis. And the you know, the Gnostics were basically Christians or Christian-related. Some of them, I think, are a bit too far from the mainstream of Christianity to really be considered Christian. They don't have Christ really as their central figure. But a lot of them were Christians who went along to the mainstream churches as well, and took part in, you know, the emerging Catholic Church movement. But they also had their own meetings, and they read their own ideas and their own inner meanings into the scriptures.
And I think a lot of people have the belief that there was a very close tie between Gnostics and Christians, you know, in the early part of their development, you know, the early church in the general sense of the word, but there were some theological, like basic theological differences, you know, that Christ wasn't the son, quote unquote, of God, and you know, the Christians didn't believe in reincarnation, and there it just had, you know, that was my understanding of the difference between the Gnostics and the Christian, was that there was just some fundamental theological differences, and not this level. I mean, we're talking a much deeper level of differences between the two groups.
Yes, well, yeah. So the kind of the current way of dividing up the Gnostic groups is the Sethians, who I mentioned, who they appeal to the figure of Seth, the third son of Adam and Eve, and the Valentinians, whose name comes from a Gnostic teacher of the second century called Valentinus, who was by all accounts a remarkable figure. He sort of thrived in the middle of the second century. And so the story goes, was standing as Bishop of Rome, you know, which is the position that later became Pope. But he didn't, wasn't elected. And anyway, historically that's slightly dubious. But so anyway, the Valentinians, they were the ones who would still attend the what was becoming the mainstream church, but they had their Gnostic beliefs. They had a kind of cosmology, you know, a view of the world and of its origins that is similar to what I was describing earlier. Whereas the Sethians, although they might still have called themselves Christians, Seth was their central figure for them, and Christ was like a reincarnation of Seth for them. So I'm not quite convinced that we should call the Sethians Christians. You know, they were Christian related, but the Valentinians actually were definitely Christians. They would definitely say that they're Christians, but they felt that there was an inner meaning to Christianity, and also this inner teaching of about Sophia and the Demiurge, and the Valentinians weren't quite so hard on the Demiurge. They thought he was ignorant, but maybe not malevolent. You know, he maybe didn't intend to be evil towards humanity. It's just that because of the fall of Sophia, and that we're sort of cut off from the spiritual world, that he just couldn't see what was above him. And maybe that even the Demiurge could be redeemed in time. You know, when you asked where the Gnostics come from, that's actually a really difficult question. Because a lot of the church fathers, as I said, treated the Gnostics as heretics. In other words, they're Christians who'd gone bad. They started off as Christians and then picked up ideas outside of Christianity, pagan ideas, that sort of thing, or made their own stuff up. And they'd gone off on the wrong track, you know, and perverted the teaching. That was the Orthodox or Catholic view of them. And of course, it wasn't the Gnostics' own view of it. They thought that what they had was really the true teaching of Jesus, you know.
As opposed to the dogmatic, just do this and it, you know, you'll be saved kind of thing. What I find interesting is that in listening to you talk, it has the cosmology that you just shared has a lot of similarities to Hindu tradition. And I'm just wondering if there is influence from Eastern religion, because obviously, you know, Hinduism was around prior to that, or if there was some influence from the Greeks or the Romans, who were obviously around at that point in time as well.
Well, definitely from the Greeks. Because as I mentioned, it was Plato who first came up with the idea of the Demiurge in a dialogue of his called the Timaeus. And he talks about the creation of the world and humanity. And he gives he comes up with this idea of a second God, who isn't the absolutely transcendent, you know, highest unified God, but Plato's demiurge is still a good God, and he creates the world, and the world is good. And the twist that the Gnostics gave to it was to make the demiurge into an evil god, or an ignorant god. But yes, there's a lot of Greek influence on the Gnostics, and also, you know, on Christianity in general. In the New Testament, it's written in Greek, you know, the whole thing, basically. And then Paul, you find Paul quoting Greek writers, classical Greek writers occasionally, and that sort of thing. As for the Hinduism and Buddhism, well, Gnosticism is being compared to Advaita Vedanta, the particular philosophical spiritual movement within Hinduism, and also to Buddhism, particularly to Mahayana Buddhism. And I think the similarities there, you know, we all have, according to Gnosticism, we all have a spark of the divine within us. And that spark belongs to the world of the Pleroma, you know, the image of God. It's not quite God yet, but it's part of the whole divine entity and realm. The spirit of each of us belongs to that world. And then in Advaita, the true self is the same for everybody. The true self of the individual human being is the same as the self of Brahma. So you can see there's a similarity there in terms of the ultimate origin, you know, the sort of highest self. And then there's similar things in Buddhism and in Mahayana Buddhism, and emphasis on sort of saving knowledge and that kind of stuff. Earlier, you know, when you said in mainstream Christianity, we do this, we do that, and we're saved, you know, you're dead right. Also, the Gnostics also had their view of salvation. You know, because we're fallen, we need to be saved. And but for them, salvation comes through gnosis. It's, you know, through knowing our true position in the world and through experiencing the divine. Now, there might be moral elements in that. And then the Gnostics in general were quite moral, you know. So sometimes just exactly the opposite has been attributed to them, which I'll maybe get onto later. But they had quite a strict morality, which often overlapped with the mainstream Christian morality. But that wasn't what saved them, you know. It wasn't, you know, not stealing or, you know, not committing adultery or whatever that saved them. It was the knowledge of their position and the experience of the divine that actually saved them. And the morality was something that would help them experience the divine and help them not be drawn down by the influence of the material world.
Well, and I think when you have that inner revelation, you end up choosing to not steal and not kill and not do all those things that they tell you are going to send you to the bad place all by yourself.
Yes, because exactly. Yeah. You might call it conscience, you know.
Yeah, all that part. The music's going to come up here in just a second. So how's about when we come back, well, actually, where I want to go next, and this might be just a very short answer, is to kind of talk a little bit about Gnosticism and the Coptic faith, because, you know, I'm just trying to dispel myths that I have in my mind, and so let's go there next. I'm Dr. Rita Louise. You're listening to Just Energy Radio. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors with Andrew Philip Smith. We're talking about his book, The Gnostics, as well as the Dictionary of Gnosticism. We'll be right back.
Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages.
Are you sensitive to energy? Want to explore the world beyond the five senses? Looking for a new career as an alternative healthcare practitioner? Then the Institute of Applied Energetics, Medical Intuition, and Energy Medicine Training Programs may be right for you. Our comprehensive curriculum provides students with a deep understanding of how to detect, evaluate, and transform the subtle body, as well as techniques for correcting energetic imbalances that may underscore a person's ability to experience radiant health. So if you are sensitive to energy, contact the Institute of Applied Energetics right away. Be a catalyst for changing the way healthcare is done around the world. Visit www.appliedenergeticsinstitute.com and start your new career today. How would you like to live long and enjoy great health? How about creating solid bones and whiter teeth? Strengthen your heart and eyes and have radiant, youthful-looking skin. There is an ancient health and longevity secret that has been used for millennia in Egypt, India, and China that can help you achieve this. For the first time in the modern world, Pearlseum brings this ancient wellness secret to you. For more information about Pearlseum, visit www.productsforthesoul.com. Before we get back to the show, I would like to thank all of you for tuning into Just Energy Radio. Many of the people I've helped over the years were listeners just like you. If you're at a junction in your life, don't stand alone at this important time. Call me or send me an email. We can set up a private consultation so that you too can experience health, healing, and wholeness in your life. To find out more about the services I offer, visit www.soulhealer.com.
Now back to Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise.
Hello and welcome back to Just Energy Radio. We're here talking with Andrew Philip Smith from AndrewPhilipSmith.com about his book, The Gnostics, History, Tradition, Scriptures, and Influence, as well as his new book, The Dictionary of Gnosticism. And I'm learning a whole lot. Andrew, before the break, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Coptic faith. You know, I will admit, you're in Ireland, so I don't even know if you get this, but we get like Discovery Channel and History Channel, and they have all these educational shows, and I've always been led to believe that the Coptic faith was a branch of Gnosticism, that they were Gnostics. Is that true? I mean, after reading this book, is that true at all?
Well, not the Coptic faith, not the modern Coptic Orthodox Church. In fact, they're not proud of their Gnostic forebears at all, I would say. Well, the word Coptic just means Egyptian. It comes from the word Egyptian, you know, just like the word gypsy does, incidentally, although, although that was actually a mistaken belief that gypsies came from Egypt. So it's just the etymological origin of the word. But the Copts are the Egyptians, you know, and what happened was we have the, you know, long-lasting and great Egyptian civilization that eventually gets conquered by Alexander the Great and his armies. And then after Alexander the Great dies, the Ptolemies, descendants of a general of his, become the rulers. And eventually, you know, Cleopatra, the famous story of Cleopatra and Antony and Julius Caesar, she's a descendant, actually, of the Greeks, who became the rulers of Egypt in its decline then. So you still have the native Egyptians, and then you have this ruling class of Greek people, and in the cities, you know, the kind of middle class of Greek people as well. And Alexandria, the city founded by and named after Alexander the Great, was the intellectual capital of the ancient world, particularly of the Greek-speaking world. And it had, you know, it was a remarkable city, the Library of Alexandria, is very famous, and there was a large Jewish population in Alexandria, and the Greek-speaking population, and also the native Egyptians. But then outside of the big cities in Egypt, the native Egyptians, who became known as the Copts, were still living and speaking the Egyptian language. And the Egyptian language went through all these different phases. You know, we talk about Old Egyptian, Middle Egyptian. And then the very latest phase of the language was called Coptic. And by that point, they were no longer writing in hieroglyphs. And the hieroglyphs themselves were replaced by another script called Demotic Egyptian script. But they started using the Greek alphabet, you know, because the educated, literate people in Alexandria spoke Greek. The other Egyptians also adopted the Greek alphabet, and they, because the Greek alphabet didn't represent enough sounds, sounds like sh or j, which don't occur in Greek, they had to invent half a dozen extra letters. So the Coptic language is the very latest stage of the Egyptian language, and it's written in the Greek alphabet with these extra letters, and it also has a large Greek vocabulary of loanwords from Greek. So the link between the Copts and the Gnostics is in the Gnostic texts that we've recovered in the last couple of centuries. Three different codices. And a codex is basically a book. It's a handwritten book, which is actually bound like the modern book, not unrolled like a scroll. And that was an important development that Christianity actually was quite responsible for at the time. You know, we wouldn't have the book in the format that we have it now if it wasn't for the Christians who needed to have a more robust and larger vehicle for their Bible, you know, which contained the New Testament and the Old Testament. This big, you know, as you know, big, thick, weighty book. Anyway, so the Gnostic texts that we discovered are in the Coptic language. And in 1945 in Egypt, at Nag Hammadi on the Nile, an illiterate goat herd called Muhammad Ali Al-Samain, I think it was, discovered a jar at the bottom of a cliff when he was out looking for fertilizer, basically kind of a kind of guano, you know, or bird droppings he was looking for. And this jar contained 12 codices, you know, codex books, written in the Coptic language. Now, by that time, even though he was a Copt, but at least there was a Coptic priest in his village. But by that time, even the Egyptian Copts, the native Egyptians, had stopped speaking the language, and they were speaking Arabic instead, you know, which is a result of the Islamic invasion. So they discovered these 12 codices, and there were another three or four which were discovered in the 19th century. And as a result, just about all of the Gnostic literature that we possess is in the Coptic language. So it's almost a kind of a coincidence. All of these works were actually written in Greek and then translated into Coptic. And they survived because Egypt has great conditions for the survival of these, you know, parchment and papyrus texts, because it's dry. It's hot and dry. It's not, and it just lends. The weather and the conditions lend themselves to the preservation of these organic materials that we use for writing. You know, we don't find survivals in, you know, Galilee very much, for example, because Galilee has quite a damp, green climate. All of just about all of our Gnostic literature is in the Coptic language, the Egyptian language written in Greek letters. But it's sort of coincidental there were Egyptians who were Gnostics, you know, along the Nile. They translated these books, they bound them and used them. But they weren't necessarily written in Egypt. And the Coptic Orthodox Church is, it's like, well, you know, the Orthodox Christianity is split from Roman Catholic Christianity. I think at the very latest, was it the 14th century, something like that, was the very late, very final split. And there were earlier splits even within the Eastern Orthodox Church. And the, I think the Coptic Christians belong to the Oriental Orthodox Church, which isn't the same as the Russian and Greek Orthodox. And they're very Orthodox in every, you know, Christian sense of the word. They don't admire these Gnostic writings. And in fact, in the 1980s, there was a brief television documentary series in the UK called The Gnostics. And they interviewed the patriarch of the Coptic Orthodox Church. And, you know, he just said, these are heretical writings, you know, the Gospels in the New Testament are the true writings. And he shrugged, you know. you know, there were Gnostics not only in Egypt, but in Rome, in Judea, in Syria, in France even, the ancient Gnostics. But the only writings that we've really been lucky enough to dig up have been in Egypt and in the Coptic language.
So what kind of things were found in that cache of codices in Nag Hammadi? I mean, I think people have heard of, like, the Gospel of Thomas. That one has become very famous. But, well, maybe even the Gospel of Mary, because there's the whole thing about, and then Jesus kissed her on the blank. Which definitely leaves a lot to your imagination.
Fill in the
blank.
But,
you know, you just, yeah. but you just hear, you know, a little quote here and a little quote there, but I would think there would be an overall, I don't know, you tell me, what kind of stuff, other than, you know, that one little quote, did they find with those documents?
Okay. Well, just for one thing, the Gospel of Mary actually wasn't found in Nag Hammadi.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's included in the collection of the Nag Hammadi scriptures or the Nag Hammadi library. But that was, I think that was in the Berlin Gnostic Codex, which was found in the 19th century. So it's actually, and then there were Greek fragments of it found. That was actually found a long time ago, you know, well over 100 years ago. About 120 years ago, probably. But because of its close link with the Nag Hammadi writings, it's included. And then the bit about Mary, you know, Jesus kissed Mary on the... And that the reason that we have dot, 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 or sometimes people just put in mouth or lips, you know, without telling us, is that there's actually a hole in the manuscript there. You know, these manuscripts of, they were compiled, in fact, in the 4th century, the Nag Hammadi ones. I mean, the writings themselves go back earlier, but the particular versions that we have, you know, come from the 4th century. And we know that actually because the bindings of the codices, to make those bindings, they use a kind of leather on the outside, but to stiffen the bindings, they reused parchment that they used before, and we have dates that some you know, parchment and papyrus were used for very ordinary day-to-day things, just like paper is used today, you know, and including, you know, bookkeeping, all that sort of stuff, tax demands. There was a great pile of the stuff was found in another place in Egypt called Oxyrhynchus, including bits of lost gospels, bits of the Greek tragedy writer Sophocles, you know, and loads and loads and loads of bureaucratic notes. Of all the things that are going to survive for 2,000 years, it's the bureaucracy that and the tax demands that manage it. But anyway, so we can date the production of those specific volumes by the binding that was used and the dates that are on these, you know, bits of bookkeeping and accounting stuff. But you know, just like, you know, I have an edition of Shakespeare that was published in 1995. That doesn't mean that Shakespeare wrote in 1995. So if we have 4th century codices, doesn't mean that the writings in them were written in the 4th century. They were copied again and again, you know, generation after generation. So the bit about Mary Magdalene, in fact, it doesn't actually specify Magdalene. It could be in the Gospel of Mary, anyway. Some people have been arguing that it was actually Mary, the mother of Jesus, who's mentioned. But the bit about Mary Magdalene kissing Jesus is in the Gospel of Philip, and I wrote a little book about that, the Gospel of Philip, annotated and explained. And that was the bit that Dan Brown drew upon in the Da Vinci Code, and the, you know, the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail and all those books before him. And yes, as it, you know, the pages start to disintegrate, and the Gospel of Judas, the one that was discovered and published just fairly recently, that's had some terrible damage to the manuscript. But the reason we don't know where he kissed her is because just there's a hole in the paper. I mean,
conveniently placed hole.
Yes. Well, not convenient for us, really. We'd love to know where he kissed her. But,
right.
I think it was the mouth, you know.
Well, let me ask you. You brought up the Da Vinci Code, and there's the allegation that there was something going on between Jesus and Mary, and that, you know, and then as far as that storyline goes, that she had a child. And is there any I don't want to say truth, that's really not the right word, but is there anything that comes out of Gnosticism or any of those texts that would lead you to believe that there was something more going on between the two of them, and that storyline, that there was even a possibility to that storyline?
I don't think so, based on the Gospel of Philip, you know, where that's found. Because the Gospel of Philip is all about metaphor and symbolism, you know, and parable. And it's not a gospel like the New Testament gospels are. It's not a narrative. It's just these little excerpts, and it might be an anthology of little bits extracted from the various previous Gnostic writings. It's a Valentinian Gnostic production. So I think my take on the Gospel of Philip is most of it is spiritual metaphor. You know, when they talk about let's assume that Jesus kissed her on the mouth, yeah? Now, in the Gospel of Thomas, the disciples drink from Jesus' mouth, and that's a metaphor for really taking in his teaching, you know. It sounds very strange, you know, like French kissing.
Sounds disgusting.
But, you know, Jesus speaks from his mouth, and they drink in what he's speaking, and they really imbibe it and understand it. So I think, you know, that if he kissed her on the mouth, I think that's what it means in the Gospel of Philip, that she understood his teaching. And so it says in the Gospel of Philip that she was his companion. It doesn't say his, you know, spouse or his wife or his concubine. It's companion. You could just about lean in the direction of concubine or something like that, if you like. But that's not really what the Gospel of Philip is interested in. It's all interested in all this spiritual metaphor, you know. But then, if you really want Jesus to have a relationship with Mary Magdalene, okay, I said that the Gospel of Philip is probably an anthology of excerpts from other writings, right? The Gospel of Philip comes from probably the late 2nd century. So all of the writings in the Gospel of Philip, all these little bits that have been excerpted, must have preceded it. And, you know, who knows how this writer chose the little bits and pieces to include. But he might have been excerpting from previous Gospel, which had this bit about Jesus and Mary Magdalene. And even though the writer of the Gospel of Philip wanted it to be metaphorical and symbolic and spiritual, the Gospel that he extracted from might have meant it literally, you know. So I offer that as kind of as a sop for people who would really like Jesus and Mary to be in a relationship. And I don't think myself that that's what the Gospel of Philip is going on about. And then Mary Magdalene crops up quite often in the Gnostic writings, and none of them are actually Gospels in any sense that resembles the four Gospels in the New Testament. But actually what you notice about Mary is that she's a disciple who really understands things well. In the Gospel of Mary, you know, a lot of the male disciples like Peter and Andrew, I think, they're arguing amongst themselves, and then they don't think, you know, they don't want to accept what Mary says because she's female. But actually, eventually they come to admit that Mary was given the special revelation by Jesus, and she received the inner teaching, and that's what all the disputes are about. And I think, I'm not sure if it's Elaine Pagels or maybe Karen King, anyway, both important female scholars of Gnosticism, who commented that, you know, this idea of Mary Magdalene maybe being the wife of Jesus, that's making her into Mrs. Jesus, you know, not into somebody who understood things in her own right, as the Gnostics were saying. Just, you know, she's Mrs. Jesus, she's the wife at home, you know, and she's the childbearer. You know, her importance is that she gave birth to a baby and then centuries later the kings of France were descended from that baby according to the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail and the Dan Brown thing and everything, you know. So the Gnostic version is actually rather more feminist, you know, and that her importance was as a disciple and as the disciple who understood the most of what Jesus taught.
And I think it's interesting because in that tradition, women actually have a place as opposed to at home sitting in front of a fire cooking.
Yes, yeah, and particularly in Mary. And another important feminine figure in Gnosticism, of course, is Sophia. You know, I mean, you could read it as the blame being put on the woman again. You know, Sophia is the eon who doesn't do what she's told, so she falls from grace, and then we have the whole mess that we're in now. But the story of Sophia is also our story. And in Gnosticism, the soul is usually a female figure. And I was waffling away, so I didn't actually get on to really address your question about the writings in the Nag Hammadi Library and what's really there. But there's an important writing called the Exegesis on the Soul. And exegesis is a technical word which is the act of bringing out the meaning of something. You know, if a pastor or a priest goes and preaches on a little bit of the Gospels in his sermon or homily on Sunday morning, that's an exegesis. He's trying to bring out the meaning of the original writing. So the exegesis on the soul is this myth about the female soul who was, she was originally in the house of the Father, and then she fell from grace into the material world, and she became seduced by thieves and adulterers, and she had to prostitute herself to them. And so this is the state of each of our souls, according to the Gnostics, as we are in the world, you know. The soul, I think, for the Gnostics, it wasn't the highest part, generally. It was what you might call kind of our internal psychology. It's the human psychology, whereas the spirit is the really divine part, the transcendent part of ourselves. So, you know, what our interior lives are like most of the times, you know. You don't have to read James Joyce to know that we have these internal monologues going on constantly. You know, we're concerned with all the seven deadly sins and everything, the, you know, envy and anger and all those things going on with us, which are, according to the Gnostics, a result of the soul being linked to the body and our interactions with the material world. So in this myth, the soul, she's a female figure, she falls from grace, she becomes a prostitute, and, you know, she's being abused by all these men who probably represent, you know, the influence of the external world and our own thoughts and desires that we have. But eventually she begins to realize the position that she's in, and she repents and she calls for help to the Father once again. And the Father, you know, hears her call, and she's able to lift herself back up again. And the culmination of the descent and then the re-ascent of the soul is for the soul to be again in the bridal chamber with the bridegroom and to make love with the bridegroom and at the wedding feast. And I think the bridegroom there represents the spirit, you know, the very highest part of ourselves, whereas the soul can be linked to the spirit and, you know, maybe has a higher origin, but it's subject, according to the Gnostic view, to the vagaries and the temptations of the material world. So that's another important female figure. You know, everybody's soul was female. And, you know, it's not an incredibly feminist view of the world, because, you know, the soul starts off with the father, a male figure. She's seduced by these other males, and then her redemption is with another male, the bridegroom. You know, we don't have to pretend too much that that they had 21st century values, you know. On the other hand, everybody's soul is feminine. You know, that's not just, that doesn't represent women. That's the story for everybody. So I think that's very important, you know, that, you know, there's the whole stuff from Joseph Campbell, the hero's journey and everything. Well, in Gnosticism, the hero's journey was a woman's journey. I think that's important.
Well, I mean, even in Judaism and, you know, in Kabbalistic thought, the soul is the Shekhinah, which is the female aspect of the self as well. So, I mean, there's even parallels and similarities in that tradition.
Yes, very much so, yeah. And the, you know, the very earliest Kabbalistic practitioners and teachings you know, may have had common roots with the Gnostics. That's quite possible. Yeah. And another important female figure is the mother figure of Barbello. This
and
is
actually,
one...
the music is going to come up here in
just one
second. Okay, I'm going to make a little note so we can come back to that. And we're going to go take another quick break. And when we come back, we're going to find out the winner of last week's mind yoga question. And so right now, we're going to go to a commercial, and we'll be back with Andrew Philip Smith talking more about the Gnostics after these words from our sponsors.
Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages.
Balance in all things is critical to maintaining health. In the hectic drive of today's world, many of us forget to take care of our most important asset, ourselves. At ProductsForTheSoul.com, we want to support your effort to nurture yourself. We offer a wide variety of herbs, supplements, and high-quality, ready-to-eat, all-natural foods. We even offer holographic chip technology products that can augment the body's natural ability to increase energy, improve sleep, and mitigate pain. Best of all of our products are delivered straight to your door. It's time to start loving yourself. Visit productsforthesoul.com and let us help you along the way. Take a journey to the dark side of the spirit world and meet the bad kids on the block in Dark Angels, an insider's guide to ghosts, spirits, and attached entities. Who are these bad kids? As a child, you might have met one at night, under your bed, in your closet, or down a dark hallway. Dark Angels is an adult dissertation about ghosts. It's filled with revealing information about how these dark forces can influence our lives. Order your copy of Dark Angels today. Visit www.darkangelsbook.com for more information.
Move past the crossroads in your life and discover alternative solutions to your deepest concerns at soulhealer.com. So whether it's a physical problem, an emotional issue, a question about work, or troubles in your relationships, naturopath and medical intuitive Dr. Rita Louise can help you. Bring peace, harmony, and health back into your life. Schedule a session today. Visit soulhealer.com right away and live the life you've been dreaming of.
Now back to Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise.
Hello and welcome back to Just Energy Radio. I'm Dr. Rita Louise and thank you all for tuning in or staying tuned to the second hour of the show. If you're enjoying the programming, please do mark this show as a favorite. And so as I said before the break, I'm going to announce the winner of last week's Mind Yoga question. And let me tell you the question, I'll give you the answer, and then I'll tell you the winner. Last week, or the winner this week, won a copy of History is Wrong by Eric Van Daniken. And here's the question. These people were a pre-Columbian civilization living in South Central Mexico from as early as 1500 BCE to about 400 BCE. The magnificent artwork produced by these people are characterized by gigantic heads that are said to resemble African facial characteristics. And the answer is the Olmec. And so last week's winner to the Mind Yoga question was our good friend and chat room monitor, Jim Barnhart. So congratulations, Jim, and you will be receiving your book in the mail in another couple of days. So let me get Andrew back on because this is just fascinating stuff. Andrew, before the break, you were talking about significant female figures that play important roles as in Gnosticism, and you were just starting on another character, and I was hoping you could continue in that vein.
Yes, that's Barbello, who's like a mother goddess, and she's... She appears in the Sethian kind of Gnosticism. If you remember the Sethians, they were the most radical, and they trace themselves back to the mythical figure of Seth, the third son of Adam and Eve. And of course, Eve herself is an important figure. You know. But Barbello, she's part of a triad or a trinity of the father, the mother, and the son. And in the Sethian system, there's the father, and there's Barbello, who is the mother goddess, and the son is called Autogenes, which is a Greek word meaning the self-begotten. So she was so important for the Sethians that some of them were actually called Barbello Gnostics, named after her. And the name is a strange one. And it's we're not really quite sure what it means. And it's an example of what is known as a barbarous word or barbarous name. And this is something that occurs in magical practice as well as in Gnosticism. You have these words that maybe meant something in one particular language, and then as they're transferred to the culture, to a different culture which speaks a different language, the meaning gets lost, and maybe the sounds get shuffled around a bit, but it becomes something significant in itself. And you know, a lot of names of magical entities have a similar quality to them, that originally they meant something, then they became distorted, and then they meant something in themselves. So we're not, there are a few guesses, but we don't really know what Barbello meant. But she was the mother figure, and you know, that's a much more natural trinity or triad, the father, the mother, and the child, than the what became the Christian trinity, where we have Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. You know, and the Holy Spirit is usually seen as masculine, you know, in modern Christianity, even though you might wonder why on earth a spirit should have a gender at all, you know, but since the Father and the Son are both masculine, why not make the Holy Spirit masculine as well? But in Hebrew, the word ruach, spirit, is feminine. So, and you know, in Hebrew and Aramaic, it would have been also been the father, the female spirit, and the child. And in Greek, that spirit, pneuma, is neuter, and spiritus in Latin is masculine. You know, so basically, the spirit moved from being female to being genderless to being male. And as a result of the grammatical qualities of these, you know, three different languages. Although I'm sure that the, you know, the preferences of the various religious bodies also had played a part in it. But yes, Eve too is important, and very often she actually represents the higher part of Adam, the spiritual part of Adam. You know, she's more connected with the world of the Pleroma. And the serpent is often a Gnostic instructor, you know, or a revealer figure. Because, you know, if the Gnostics, you know, if they're going to read Genesis, read about the tree of knowledge, and gnosis means knowledge of good and evil, you know, is that going to be a good tree or a bad tree? You know, obviously the tree of knowledge is a good tree for Gnostics. And so the serpent was a good figure, actually bringing the truth to Eve and Adam. And the god in the garden is an ignorant or evil figure, trying to stop them from seeing the truth. And he's created this world completely ignorant of the higher realm above him and the true nature of things. You know, he's trying to trap the humanity, and it's the serpent who brings knowledge to humanity and enables humanity to achieve gnosis.
So I'm going to switch gears here and ask a question that is a little bit controversial. Actually, we did a show on this topic fairly recently. It was... I was really shocked at how well it was received, actually, but I think asking you, because you come from a totally different place, I really like to hear your opinion. But I heard recently, you know, based on that show, that there were some Gnostic sects that didn't even believe that Jesus was a real person, but only was a myth. And is that true?
Well...
I mean, you know, there's the part about, like, was Jesus true? And then there's the part, were there Gnostic groups that actually thought that Jesus was a myth? So I guess,
yes,
I'm kind of asking a two-part question.
Okay. So the first one, do I believe that Jesus was a real person or that he originated as a myth? Yeah. I'd have to say, on balance, I think he was a real person. Now, if you really go to the cutting edge and, you know, whittle everything down to, you know, the bare minimum of what should be accepted in terms of the Gospels and the story of early Christianity, I would say that we know almost nothing about Jesus, you know. That if you take a fairly skeptical point of view and you want any evidence to be either corroborated by something or to be in a kind of, have a factual framework even at the beginning. You know, if you look at the Gospels, the quest for the historical Jesus has been going on since the late 19th century and originated in France and Germany and with the early academic study of the Gospels and the New Testament. You know, and so the basic question there is, if we treat the Gospels and the other New Testament writings in the same way that we would treat any other writings, you know, in a historical way, what do we come up with? You know, if we don't privilege it and say, you know, well, Jesus could walk on water, even though I've never seen anybody else walk on water, and even though if I came across an account of some other ancient figure walking on water, I wouldn't accept it, you know. So basically, coming from a secular rationalist point of view, you have to say that didn't happen. Jesus didn't walk on water. Or, you know, if you're a fundamentalist Christian, of course, you say that Jesus did walk on water, but nobody else in the history of literature and anecdotal evidence has ever walked on water. It only happened to Jesus, and it was absolutely different for Jesus, you know. That's not a very historical way to approach it. And you can only really take that approach if you're speaking to people who share your faith with you. You know, if you find out that Krishna walked on water, then, you know, a Christian isn't going to believe that. And, you know, then you have to look at, if you're going to look historically at the life of Krishna, you know. If you say that Christ walked on water, why shouldn't Krishna walk on water? Yeah. So that's the basic, view of the method behind the historical Jesus. It's the historical critical method. You treat the Gospels like you treat any kind of ancient writing, you know. If some miraculous element creeps in, you have to put it to one side, you know, as that was the belief of the people who wrote this thing up, you know. As modern secularists, we can't say that happened, you know. And then you find out that little episodes in the New Testament actually reflect episodes in the Old Testament, refer to them, you know, obviously modeled on them. And, so what do you do then? Do you actually just throw those out of the window? Say, no, they're obviously created on the basis of these new Old Testament stories because people thought that Jesus had to do the same things that the Old Testament prophets and figures like Moses did, you know. Or do you say, well, Jesus probably did something like that, but it was changed so that people would recognize the references to the Old Testament, you know. Again, if you're a Christian, you'd say that it was prefigured by something in the Old Testament. Jesus really did that, and it was prefigured by the Old Testament because the Old Testament points towards Christ, the coming of Christ.
Well, I mean, and I could see very easily where some of the stories in there were, manufactured, given a little facelift. There's always the story about the guy who caught the fish, you know, and in the Bible or, you know, in the New Testament, there's the story of the fish and loaves. And I always joke around, you know, he had a little lox and a bagel. They had a nosh, you know, but, you know, and it spread around to 5,000 people. Is there truth in that story or was it kind of this little fish that became huge?
Well, the fascinating thing about some of those stories is that they're full of numerical symbolism. In the Gospel of John, the story, I think it's a post-resurrection story, the resurrected Jesus appears, they go fishing on the lake, they throw their nets on one side, they don't pull in any fish, and if I'm remembering correctly, they throw the net on the other side, they pull in 153 fish. And this number, the numbers in the story actually produce a diagram. There's a scholar called David Feideler who has written very interestingly about this in a book called Son of God, I think. And also he found in the story of the feeding of the 5,000. I mean, see, there are two feedings. There's the feeding of the 5,000 and there's the feeding of the 4,000. You know, it's a doublet. There are two versions of the story, you know. And then, of course, in the Gospels, there are all sorts of, you know, the Matthew, Mark, and Luke are known as the synoptic Gospels because you can arrange them eye to eye in a synopsis, and you can see that they share material, and that material occurs mostly in the same order. And there's obviously a literary relationship between those, you know. It's not just that we have three eyewitnesses coming from their different points of view, or even that we have three different takes on oral tradition. At least one or two of those writers has actually read the other texts and used them when they're writing their own texts. And the usual, the standard scholarly view of that is that Mark came first. Matthew and Luke each used the Gospel of Mark writing their own Gospels. And then they use a document which you now have lost, which is known by the scholars as Q. It comes from the German word Quelle, which means source, which provides the material that's common to Matthew and Luke. There's also a not quite so popular, but another version that I find interesting that simply says that Luke used Matthew and Mark. But in any case, there's a literary relationship. These people were sitting down with earlier versions of the Gospels, copying bits out, changing them, adding their own material, reordering this stuff a little bit. There's a scholar, Stephen Davis, actually, who republished one of his books, and he likes to tell his students that he's a professor at a Catholic college, actually, in Pennsylvania. But he tells his students that we know more about Jesus than Matthew did. Because Matthew just had, he had Mark, and he had this lost source called Q, and a few other bits and pieces. We actually know more about Jesus than Matthew did, even though we might think, you know, we might not know much about Jesus at all, you know. So it's very difficult to find anything really solid historically. I mean, some, you know, scholars still go through the stuff with a tooth comb and try and sort out what's more likely, you know, if and the sayings of Jesus are actually a bit more historically reliable than the deeds of Jesus. And there's been a lot of work in the last sort of 20-30 years on the sayings tradition, because the Q Gospel, if it ever existed, consists mostly of sayings, you know, with little bits of narrative to give a bit of context to the sayings. And the Gospel of Thomas, you know, the most famous of the Nag Hammadi writings, it's a sayings gospel. It's a list of sayings of Jesus with a few bits of dialogue, you know, tiny bit of description of the setting, but it's sayings. The sayings of Jesus might be more authentic than the deeds attributed to Jesus. The Gnostics, they read the Gospels in the New Testament as well, and they read them symbolically. They saw lots of references even to their own cosmology in the Gospel of John and also the three other Gospels. So that's the thing about the historical Jesus is, there's very little that's historical in it. And possibly the most solid thing is the crucifixion, because that's so important to Paul in his letters. And Paul, the writings of Paul precede the four Gospels. They're written before the four Gospels. There are very few people who would argue against that. So people who believe that Jesus never existed as a real person, they look at the lack of historical evidence, and then they look at Paul's earliest version of Christ, and, you know, who he was crucified, he rose again. There's a little bit about the Last Supper, doesn't mention Judas, you know, just that it sets the tone for the sacrament of the Eucharist, you know, which is obviously very early Christian practice, and also very important to the Gnostics, and of course survives to this day as an essential part of Catholic and Anglican tradition in the Mass. So, you know, Paul thought Jesus was crucified, he rose again, he had this Last Supper, maybe he was born of woman, that's a bit arguable, and that's about it. So the people like Tim Freake and Peter Gandy, who wrote the Jesus Mysteries, and Carrier S., who was her book, The Christ Conspiracy, or something like that, and Earl Doherty, he's written the most scholarly investigation into this, the Jesus puzzle. They look at how little we know about Jesus as a person, and how much Paul's view of Jesus resembles the mystery religions that were around at those times in the Roman Empire, which too had these dying and rising savior figures, and an identification of the believer with the god. You know, everything from Dionysus to Mithras to Attis, all these ancient mystery cults. And, you know, so what they're saying is, rather than, you know, clawing into the earth, trying to get these tiny little fragments of slightly possible historical episodes from a human figure, Jesus, why not say instead that the human figure was a later development? What we had at the beginning was this Jewish version of this dying and rising God, got taken over by Gentiles, and then at some stage, and was basically, you know, a mystical religion, and then fairly early on got sort of literalized and progressively became a more human figure, which incidentally is the opposite of what Dan Brown was saying in the Da Vinci Code, you know, which isn't terribly accurate historically either, you know. His version was that Jesus was human and then he got made into a god, whereas the mythicists are saying that Jesus was a god who was then seen as having come down to the world in mythical time, and then was gradually became sort of euhemerized into a human figure, you know. So I find that very interesting, and I'm also very skeptical about historical reconstruction of Jesus. Although I have a feeling that I'll do one myself one day and write a book about it, even though I'm skeptical about it. But I've never been quite able to make that step to say that I think Jesus originated as a myth. I think there is a man there somewhere, and
I agree.
It represent that man, you know.
I think it would be hard to start a whole movement without having somebody, you know, to form it around. One of the things that you said earlier was that in some of the traditions, Christ wasn't even the main figure. And so did they believe that Christ was the Son of God? Do they believe in the whole resurrection thing that, you know, he died, he came back, ascended into heaven? Do they believe in that part, or do they think that he was just a man, you know, a man who was sharing insights?
Well, it's very interesting that you bring that up after the mythicist question, you know. The Sathians, they're the people who I wouldn't quite call Christians. I would call them Christian-related. But for them, Seth is the central figure. Jesus is basically like an avatar or an incarnation of Seth. And it's Seth who's central. But still, you know, Jesus does figure heavily in their writings. Like the Gospel of Judas, which was discovered and published fairly recently, is Sethian. So their version of the crucifixion and resurrection is very connected to this view of Jesus. And, you know, it's very difficult to tell whether, in some ways, whether they saw Jesus as a real person or as a myth or whether it made no difference to them. But there's an aspect of Gnosticism which is called the Docetic viewpoint, D-O-C-E-T-I-C, so that's Doceticism or Docetism. And that comes from another Greek word, to show, which means that Jesus only appeared on earth in appearance. He wasn't physically here. He didn't have a physical body like your body and my body. But he was on earth, and he had this sort of soul body, or maybe he had a soul body and a spiritual body. There are disagreements about that. You know, why would people say something like that? Well, of course, there's the, you know, the whole aspect of the mythicist view of Jesus and Paul's view of Jesus. And Paul actually was very influential on the Gnostics. You know, the Valentinian Gnostics really loved him. They called him the Great Apostle. And, you know, which is a little bit at odds with what, you know, alternative Christianity today might think about Paul, you know. Paul's a bit of the sort of stereotypical view of Paul is he's a bit of a brute who didn't like women and didn't know Jesus and you know, made his own religion and ignored Jesus' own teachings.
I think Paul was a great salesman because he sold that religion to a lot of people.
Yes, right. But the Gnostics really liked Paul. They called him the Great Apostle. And so anyway, so the Sethians, so if we have this view, we're trapped in the material world, you know, the body, at worst, it's a, you know, it might be a prison and this very negative thing that has to be disciplined. At the least, you know, it's not our true identity, you know. Again, there are lots of different views about the importance of the body, and at the most extreme end, it was evil. But for most Gnostics, I think it was just it just wasn't the real self. You have to look after it. You can even appeal to the various archons who created parts of the body for in terms of healing in a kind of magical way. But it's not the true self. That resides in the spirit, and the part that comes from the pleroma, the heavenly world. So why would Jesus have a body if he's come from the heavenly world? And maybe he needs to have a soul so he can come down and teach us, but did he really need to have a body? And what's the importance of the crucifixion? You know, when you had these Christians running towards martyrdom and a lot of emphasis on, you know, Jesus' physical body being crucified and then his actual physical body coming back to life again in a prefiguration of what will happen to us all after we die and we become resurrected in our physical bodies, according to standard Christianity, you know. You can see how why the Gnostics would have said, no, he didn't have a physical body at all, you know, because they're trying to address this, you know, issue of physical resurrection and everything to do with that. So in some of these Sethian texts, including the Gospel of Judas, well, not quite the Gospel of Judas, actually, but when Jesus is crucified, it's not really Jesus who is crucified. It's either somebody else, Simon, in some places it said, is crucified, probably referring to Simon of Cyrene, who carried the cross for Jesus.
in the Gospels. But Jesus himself is above the cross in a sort of spiritual body, laughing. And it's a lovely image, you know, this like a laughing Buddha, this laughing Jesus above the cross, not touched by the suffering. Unfortunately, the Sethians go and ruin it a little bit. I have to get back to that, yeah.
Okay. We need to take another break. When we come back, we will be asking this week's mind yoga question. So spend the break stretching your brain, because we have a question coming up. And after that, we'll be back with Andrew Philip Smith talking more about the Gnostics. But we'll be back.
Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages.
Go deep inside yourself and venture into the realm of the unconscious mind with my Meditating on the Kabbalah Guided Imagery audio CDs. Discover who you are and what you want in life. Meditating on the Kabbalah can help you to open, clear, and revitalize the energetic pathways of your subtle being. They will support you in your spiritual quest by helping you to access the profound insights and inner guidance you need as you work in alignment with your highest good. Let them help you to release negative thoughts and emotions and clear away any limitations that may be keeping you from experiencing your full potential. Walk down the path to health, healing, understanding, and enlightenment with Meditating on the Kabbalah. Order your copy today at www.soulhealer.com. That's right, that's www.soulhealer.com.
Hi, I'm James Altayanchik, the Black Knight of Talk Radio. Listen to Dr. Rita's Soul Healer Moment live each third Sunday night of the month on Feet to the Fire. www.feettofire.com for more information.
Hi, I'm Dr. Rita Louise, the host of Just Energy Radio and the founder of the Institute of Applied Energetics. Start a new career today on the leading edge of alternative health and healing. The Institute of Applied Energetics can help you develop the specialized skills you need to work as an energy medicine practitioner, intuitive counselor, or professional medical intuitive. Besides our outstanding technical instruction, our programs also support you in creating and building a successful business in this rapidly growing field. Be a catalyst for changing the way healthcare is done around the world. Contact the Institute of Applied Energetics right away or visit AppliedEnergeticsInstitute.com.
And now back to Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise.
Hello and welcome back to Just Energy Radio. I'm Dr. Rita Louise, and we're here talking with Andrew Philip Smith about his books, The Gnostics, as well as his Dictionary of Gnosticism. But there's the music, which means it's time for this week's mind yoga question. So this week, the person who sends an email to justenergyradio@yahoo.com with the correct answer will win a copy of Mark Savage's Freemasonry book. So here's the question. On Friday, October 13th, under the orders of King Philip of France, leaders of this religious order were arrested and charged with a number of offenses, including idolatry, heresy, obscene rituals, financial corruption, and secrecy. Let me read that again. On Friday, October 13th, under the orders of King Philip of France, leaders of this religious order were arrested and charged with a number of offenses, including idolatry, heresy, obscene rituals, financial corruption, and secrecy. So if you think you know the answer, if you kind of think you know the answer, if your mind is feeling expanded and open because you've just done some mind yoga, send an email to justenergyradio@yahoo.com, and you can possibly win, if you're the first one to answer the question right, a copy of Freemasonry by Mark Savage. Savage. And if you're listening to this show in archive, please do try and answer the question, especially if it's right after the show has aired live, because we have had a number of winners who have been archive listeners. So let me get Andrew back on the line and continue this fascinating conversation. Hi, Andrew. Welcome back. And so before the break, we were talking about Christ and the crucifixion and that whole concept. And just to let you know, we're in the last half hour. We have about 20 more minutes left. So.
Okay, yeah.
Well, I have, you know, it's like,
hours,
I have so much. I know. I mean, it's just fascinating.
I was talking about the laughing Jesus. Unfortunately, that's not quite as delightful an image as we might suppose, because Jesus is often laughing at people, and he's laughing at the incorrect view of himself. He's laughing at the crowd who believe that he's being crucified, but actually what is being crucified isn't Jesus at all. You know, that body isn't the true Jesus. The true Jesus is the being laughing above the cross. So the crucifixion itself wasn't so important for the Gnostics. And in the Gospel of Thomas, although it's not strictly a Gnostic writing, but it's used by Gnostics, the crucifixion isn't mentioned at all. You know, Jesus is entirely a teacher. And then the Valentinians put a lot of emphasis on the resurrection, but the resurrection should occur in this life. We don't have to wait until we die to have the resurrection. So you can see that kind of resurrection is this kind of spiritual awakening, and it's receiving gnosis, experience of the divine. That's a resurrection that frees us from the limitations of just the material world and gives us access to the spirit and the bridal chamber. And a number of the Gnostic Gospels, the writings, not all of them are called Gospels, but the ones that include Jesus in them and have Jesus with his apostles, like the Gospel of Mary, most of those in the Gnostic tradition are actually post-resurrection. You know, the New Testament Gospels, they look at the life of Jesus, the earthly life of Jesus, and the resurrection is just right at the end of it, and the post, a bit of post-resurrection dialogue. And in the original version of the Gospel of Mark, we didn't even have a resurrection. We just have the woman at the tomb. But the Gnostics, they sort of filled in the blanks, and they had these post-resurrection Gospels and post-resurrection dialogues between Jesus and his disciples. Jesus wasn't back just for 30 days. He was back for 555 days in one of them. And you have Jesus giving the Gnostic teachings to his disciples, very elaborate accounts of the formation of the world and the cosmology and the the story of the Pleroma, the heavenly world, and the fall of Sophia, and the progress of mankind. This is all put into the mouth of Jesus after his resurrection. So in a way, they trumped mainstream Christianity by having the secret teachings of Jesus after his resurrection, which surely must exceed the teachings of his earthly life, because then he was completely redeemed and ascended and, godly.
So these were two separate questions, but based on time, I'm going to kind of consolidate them into one.
Okay, that might take me longer.
Well, but they're kind of related. Why did Gnosticism die off? And then the second part is, there seems to be a resurgence in the interest in Gnosticism, and I was just wondering why that was or why you think that's happening.
The second one's easier, but I'd have to start with the first one.
You can start wherever you like.
Okay,
you have 15 minutes.
Why did it die off as nearly as difficult as where did it start? Why did it die off? Well, we can see, you know, we had the sort of church ascendance. We had the, you know, the Roman Catholic come Orthodox Church triumphed over the other smaller branches of Christianity. And when Constantine the Great eventually adopted Christianity as his religion, and it became, with his successors, the religion of the Roman Empire as a whole, and acquired, you know, a lot of political clout and influence, temporal power was put into the hands of the Orthodox Church, the Roman Catholic Church. And, you know, even in the second century, there are lots of heresiologists, heresy hunters, or people who said heresies, these church fathers who were attacking the Gnostics in their writings and claiming that their version of Christianity was the right one and all others were heresies and perversions. So it was squeezed out, basically. It was squeezed out politically, and the Gnostic group ceased to expand. And then, the story of, you know, that they're all slaughtered by the Catholics is a myth, really. There's only a tiny little bit of evidence of violence against Gnostics. And one example is that a Valentinian Gnostic church was attacked by the Orthodox. And, you know, Roman Catholic is a little bit, you know, it's a touchy term to use because there are people who are still Roman Catholics, obviously. You know, it's the largest church in the world. And Orthodox suggests the Eastern Orthodox Church, but Roman Catholic, you know, Catholic or Orthodox, that was the emerging mainstream church anyway. So there was one example where a Valentinian church was attacked, another example where Gnostics were attacked by another supposedly heretical group, you know. But basically they were squeezed out. The emerging mainstream church had a stranglehold, and people lost interest in the Gnostics. And then a lot of the sort of Gnostic impulse became absorbed into the Manichaean movement. And there was a teacher called Mani, who was a third century teacher, who drew on Gnostic ideas, but also on Buddhism and other traditions, and Judaism, Christianity, and he sort of emphasized the radical duality. I mean, we haven't really mentioned dualism much, but dualism is the idea that there are two forces opposing each other in the universe, and so for many, the light and dark were in opposition, and the world that we have is a result of the mixing of light and dark, and it's kind of a transforming apparatus to extract the light from which is mixed into with the darkness, to allow people to do that personally by experiencing the light within their own souls, and then even to do things like vegetables like cucumbers and melons with thoughts contain more light. So the Manichaeans were particularly keen on those vegetables. So Mani's religion, Manichaeism, became very influential, and although for the most part it was never in the majority in any country, with the exception of the Uyghur Empire, something like the 8th century, I think it was, 8th or 9th century, briefly, they were always in a minority. So they were very widespread. They spread into China and even as far west as Spain. But they were never a majority religion. And St. Augustine, or Augustine, was a Manichaean before he was a Christian. So many Gnostics became absorbed into the Manichaean movement. And basically, they were just hit on all sides. Christians were more concerned with the mainstream Christianity because of the political advantage of that. Manichaeanism was an exciting new religion that absorbed Gnostics. Other Gnostics were interested in Neoplatonism. And they may have survived till about the 7th century, these original Gnostics, like the Valentinians. But they slowly died out. But there were the successors. The Manichaeans lasted for a very long time. If there weren't Gnostics, there were at least Christian dualists, a group called the Paulicians, who were in Turkey towards the end of the first millennium. And then they possibly passed some teachings over to the Bogomils, who lived in Bulgaria and the former Yugoslavia in the early medieval period. And then the Cathars, who were very well known in the medieval period. So there's arguably this chain of influence from the original ancient Gnostics through the Manichaeans, the Paulicians, the Bogomils, to the Cathars. And then the Cathars really were persecuted by the Catholic Church. There was an entire crusade declared purely, with the aim of eliminating the Cathar heresy from the lands of southern France. And they were slaughtered, they were burned, they were tortured. The Inquisition was brought into being as a prime instrument for interrogating them.
And they were Christian-ish group.
They were Christians. They called themselves the Good Christians. And,
just checking.
Yeah. They were Christians. They didn't know the Gnostic writings. And we don't have all that much in terms of their own writings. We have, the interrogations from the Inquisition. They survive. And a few bits of their writings. So they didn't know the writings of the ancient Gnostics, but they had this view that the world was created by Satan, and which, like Satan is the demiurge figure. And they also believed in reincarnation. And they had a ceremony called the Consolatum, which brought the Holy Spirit down into them. And they were also very moral. They had very strict rules for the perfect, for the inner circle of the Cathars. These very limiting restrictions on them actually resemble the restrictions on the inner circle of the Manichaeans. I think there's a definite connection there, So the Cathars really were exterminated. And I think it's in the 14th or 15th century. You see this, the last straggling group of Cathars, they get the chop as well. Which doesn't mean that, if you're looking at sort of mystical or esoteric Christianity, there are lots of other strands of it apart from the Gnostics. And then, of course, you have the rise of Protestantism, the fragmentation of the Christian Church, and things opening up a great deal. It's no longer the monoculture that it was in the Middle Ages. But in terms of any direct influence from the Gnostics, I would say, or indirect influence even, I'd say it dies out with the Cathars, in about the 14th mm-hmm. century, early 15th century. You mentioned the Knights Templars. I'm not sure if I really see any Gnostic teachings in their doctrines, but again, we don't know too much of their own secret teachings. We have these tantalizing fragments, and what we know of them is the the gross external elements. So in terms of that kind of line, we have the Cathars as the end of it. However, there was another group called the Mandaeans, who were very much Gnostics. They're very dualist, this clash between light and dark. There's a demiurge figure. They're somewhat similar to the Manichaeans in their mythology, although they're not identical. And they're tracing, they're still going. They were living in southern Iraq and Iran, around the border there. And they've been very badly affected by the Iraq war and the, you know, the state of affairs, all the fighting in Iraq and the ethnic violence, all that sort of stuff. And they have managed to, to a certain extent, they have a diaspora, and they've emigrated to the West or to Syria as well. As a result of that, they're somewhat losing their religion. And in fact, I have a Facebook friend who's a Manichaean, Mandean, who lives in Birmingham or Manchester in England. And he's just doing all his Facebook updates about getting drunk and what any other English fellow of his age would be doing. The people themselves are managing to escape to some extent and have refugee status. And New Jersey, New York State, Los Angeles, I think there are a number of Mandeans have settled there. But they're becoming very secularized. Their religion was already in a bit of a state of crisis. But they're the last survivors of the historical Gnostics, really. And it's, you know, one of the tragedies of the Iraq War. Under Saddam Hussein, they were somewhat tolerated, I think, because there were other ethnic groups in the area who were targeted by Saddam Hussein. So, yes.
There were ones that he hated
that,
more.
Were, yeah,
that's bad.
As long as they kept quiet, they were tolerated. And they qualified as people of the book for Muslims. So they had the secondary status like Christians and Jews do. But then that relative equilibrium of them was broken with the Iraq War, and you know, there was a lot with no centralized government and everything. There was lots of ethnic violence, and they were suffering a lot. And then, in fact, the Muslims became more opposed to the Mandeans. You know, if Mandeans wanted to go to school, you know, there was a lot of pressure to them. Them to convert to Islam, that kind of thing. But anyway, so the Mandeans, they're a direct continuation, and they trace themselves back to John the Baptist, and it's as uncertain as anything at that time, you know, whether how historical that is, but they have a decent claim to that. So there's been a resurgence of interest in Gnosticism as the texts themselves have been discovered. And for a long time, we only really knew about the Gnostics from their enemies, from these obnoxious church fathers of the starting in the late 2nd century and going on, people like Irenaeus and Hippolytus, Tertullian, Epiphanius, who were attacking the Gnostics. And now that we have actual Gnostic texts, we can assess what they're writing a bit more, you know. In some cases, they describe a myth which very much resembles the Sethian Gnostic myth. In other cases, they're just really coming up with slander and making stuff up to discredit the Gnostics. You know. So for a long time, that was all we had. And then we suffered in the 19th century. Some Gnostic codices were discovered in Coptic. The Coptic language wasn't well known in the West, and it was already a dead language in the sense that Latin is in Egypt. It was just used for services, and it wasn't spoken very much, and, if at all, you know, by the Copts themselves. So it took a while for academia to rediscover the Coptic language and be able to translate those texts. Pistis Sophia is a fairly well-known Gnostic text that's been available since the 19th century. Very difficult one, very repetitive, very long, late, you know, possibly Gnosticism in decline, with lots of influence from other movements like the Manichaeans. But anyway, people rediscover the Gnostic texts, and in the 19th century, along with the sort of Romantic movement, and the interest in the Knights Templars and in Freemasonry and all that sort of thing, there was a resurgence of interest in Gnosticism. And by the late 19th century, there were Gnostic churches in France, because France felt a particular connection with the Gnostics because of the Cathars. You know, mm-hmm. Cathars are part of the French heritage in the south. And so there were these new Gnostic churches that were part of the independent Catholic movement, and people who felt that the Mass was an important way to celebrate or experience the divine, but broke away from the Church of Rome and the influence of the Pope and all the other doctrines that go along with that. And then that kind of fragmented a lot, but made its way into the 20th century, and then there were other strands. And then, particularly since the publication of the Nag Hammadi Library, and it was only in 1978 that the entire library was released in English translation for the general public. It took a long time. It wasn't as bad as the Dead Sea Scrolls, but it still took quite a long time to make it all available. And, there's a lot of, there are several different Gnostic churches, many which, claim lineage from the French churches, or from other lineages, or some people who are just trying to use the Gnostic scriptures to approach their own spirituality. And that's one thing about the Gnostics, is what we're left with. We don't know a great deal about what they did, The Valentinians celebrated the Eucharist. The baptism was important. It was very important for the Mandaeans. The Mandaeans have weekly baptisms. It wasn't a one-off thing for the Mandaean religion. But we don't know a great deal about what they did. We know what they wrote. We know their myths, and they didn't tell us a great deal about their own history either. They told us about their mythical history. They're the children of Seth, the descendants of Seth, but they didn't tell us much about their literal history. So we can see that there are connections between the Gnostics and the Hermetica, these writings that came out of Egypt around the first, second century, that have some similarities, that they have the sort of good demiurge in the Hermetic writings. But there are several similarities. Gnosis is mentioned in the Hermetica. So there's a family resemblance there. The Hermetic writings and the Gnostic writings are part of the same family, even if they're not quite the same thing. There's a revival in Gnostic churches, people trying to, in a kind of church, independent church setting, to use Gnostic ideas. And also in literature, people like Philip K. Dick, the science fiction writer. Oh, is that it?
That's it.
Oh, dear. Well, your listeners will just have to read my book.
They'll just have to get the books. Yeah. And so the name of the two books, the primary one we've been talking about is called The Gnostics, History, Tradition, Scriptures, Influence. And his new book is The Dictionary of Gnosticism, and both of them are available in the bookstores. Andrew, thank you so much for coming on. I could listen to you for hours and hours and hours. This is just fascinating. And we'll have to have you back.
Yes, well, lovely questions, Ruth.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
And next week we're doing like this whole UFO thing. In the first hour we have Nick Redfern talking about a history of alien-human interaction. The second hour, Kevin Randall, UFOs, the evidence, the cover-ups, and the hoaxes. So until next week, I'm Dr. Rita Louise. Be blessed.
Join host Dr. Rita Louise each week at this time for Just Energy Radio. Point your browser to www.justenergyradio.com for more show information and to contact Dr. Rita. Until next time, remember, it's all just energy.